Okay, we are back. All right, so I was just mentioning that the AGU meeting, which starts December 5th, is 5 days, but the climate literacy, we have five climate literacy sessions on different themes. So one is on K-12 education focus, one's on higher education, one's on informal science education, one's on research and evaluation, and I think then there's one more, and I...
There's one, yeah, we're doing one on integrating research with education.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Thank you, Mark. So, and different ones, so I'm chairing the session on the K-12, and Mark is chairing the session on integrating research and education. And so we have various other people from the Climate Literacy Network are chairing the rest of the sessions. The other thing is that the tri-agency group, NASA, NOAA, and NSF, are going to have a meet and greet, I believe, on Tuesday night. The climate literacy sessions are Monday and Tuesday mostly. So that was the information I had. Are there other announcements?
This is Roberta. I'm Roberta Burns from Kentucky. I just wanted to mention that I did a climate education training a couple weeks ago that was for state and federal agency representatives, and we had some interesting attendees at the workshop. I had the field representative for Congressman Whitfield at the workshop. Whitfield is one of our illustrious Kentucky congressmen who is working to gut the Clean Air Act, among other things. So it was kind of fun having his field rep there. She really had a good time with the hands-on activities when she wasn't on her BlackBerry. but she went home with wide eyes saying, you know, wow, I didn't know any of this was happening in Kentucky. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think
so was this for the state, for reps in the state of Kentucky, or was this a national?
She is the field rep for our national, one of the U.S. congressmen, Ed Whitfield, who is from Western Kentucky.
Yeah, but the training that you ran.
Oh, the training was a regional training. It was mainly Kentucky, but we had a couple of regional people from outside of Kentucky, from mm-hmm. Fish and Wildlife and Forestry as well.
Great. Other
announcements? Just as a general reminder, you know, as far as materials to support those things, you guys all remember that you can request those materials to be sent to you. So if you needed the climate literacy document or other materials.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, I had plenty of copies, or I would have requested more. So I gave them all the climate literacy handouts, and we did several activities, and they got copies of all of that stuff. So thanks.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Are there other announcements? Okay, well, if not, we'll move on to our presentation for today. We have Meredith Hare and Kara Pike from the Research Innovation Group's Social Capital Project, and they're going to be talking to us about this a climate access project, introducing the Climate Access Network. So, Kara and Meredith, I'll turn it over to you.
Great.
The slides are on the website if you haven't downloaded them already.
And if you're at your computer, feel free to check out climateaccess.org as we're talking through the project. Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be able to share our project with you. And definitely know a few folks on the phone and really very much supportive of the work you're all doing on climate literacy. Our focus at the Resource Innovation Group is running the Social Capital Project, which is an effort to try and close the gap between environmental interest and action. We try and bridge from research into practice, and our current focus, and I guess the focus now for the past 5 years or so, has been on climate communications and behavior change. I believe a number of you know the Climate Leadership Initiative, which is also part of TRIG, and Sarah Mazzi, who's been engaged with some of the climate literacy work. So we do a lot of research, but we also do a lot of training. Some of our work has involved two of the largest studies in the country on Americans and their environmental and climate attitudes, the social values that underlie them. We're very much focused on informal education and, in particular, trying to build public support for climate policy and behavior change programs. We, in addition to research and training, do pilot projects and technical assistance efforts. So we partner with nonprofits and governments primarily around campaign development in support of things like climate action plans. And at this point, I think we've trained more than 2,000 practitioners in climate communications and behavior change over the last several years. Our first effort, and really where a lot of our work grew out of, was working on behalf of an association of 33 national environmental groups, where we developed a meta-narrative for all of their political advocacy around climate issues that would allow organizations from population groups to Native American rights to conservationists to public health organizations to still speak within a common framework and mutually reinforce one another's messages. So out of that work, we've done a lot of training, and we've heard from the practitioner community a number of key challenges and needs that we're really trying to address now with our new project, Climate Access. So that's really what we're going to focus on for the presentation today. And I'll kick us off, and then Meredith will come in later when we show you some of the functionality of the online platform that we've created to support the new network that we're developing of climate communicators and behavior change professionals. So our sense from being out there trying to build public support on climate action as well as doing the training across the United States and Canada is that we haven't really made enough progress when it comes to engaging the public in these issues, and that really in addition to just getting policies passed, public support will be critical for implementation and really for trying to achieve the kind of transformational change that's necessary to address climate issues. So we feel that the public has a very critical role to play, and that is often overlooked when we're problem solving around these issues. As a result, often the communications and public engagement efforts are under-resourced, and the practitioners responsible for them are often isolated within their organizations, or in some cases, the people working on the issues are scattered across multiple government agencies and organizations. So not connected to each other, not really taking advantage of what people are learning, what people are finding is effective. So we're really looking to address that challenge. The other key thing that we've seen is that we are making a lot of headway when it comes to social science and understanding how the public thinks about these issues, how motivation works, how change works on individual, organization, even societal levels. And yet often that research and knowledge is not making it into the field either. And finally, we're not really tracking and adding up what is happening on the ground. So Climate Access and this new climate communications network that we're creating is looking to address those challenges. And really, we heard three key things over and over from being out there training staff from nonprofits and government. And the first was really the need to synthesize and analyze the fire hose of information that is out there related to public engagement and climate. There's a reason that the research isn't getting out there and what we are learning isn't necessarily being applied, and people are, for the most part, overwhelmed by the amount of information coming their way. They can't necessarily tell the difference in what the polling is saying, and often ideas in particular from academia are not really making their way into the practitioner space. The other thing...
Can I interrupt you for a second? Can you... I think you've been moving through your slides, but you haven't been saying you've been moving through them. Can you tell people where you are?
Oh, sure. I'm on slide 4, and no worries. We either way, looking at the slides, or if you're on the website, you'll also be able to follow and check some of the key things. But I am on slide 4 and about to move into slide 5. Thanks, though.
Okay. But, yeah, just mention as you move to the next slide.
Okay, great. Thank you. Another key thing that we heard was that even when people have access to research, often they're not sure how the guidance and how the idea should really play out in campaign work. So how do you actually go from research into practice? What is working on the ground? And ideally, more closely connect what is happening in the academic research thought leadership community with the field of practice and create good feedback mechanisms. So what's happening on the ground can also feed back into the research cycle. And finally, to create a network of networks. People want help with their own particular organizations or agencies' climate communication challenge, but they also want to know what other people are doing. And that's really the core idea behind Climate Access, is not to duplicate any effort that is going on out there, but rather to bring it together, organize it, and try and tie it together to get greater leverage. So now moving to the next slide, to slide 5 and then 6. So we're just going to now shift and show you how some of these key ideas are playing out within the network. The network, as I said, is practitioners from nonprofits and government agencies from really all levels of government, federal down to municipal, nonprofits of a variety of sizes. And basically, we are still going to continue our offline activities of doing trainings and workshop and research, et cetera. But we're really trying to bring everyone together into an online community to share information and best practices. So the first piece is really around synthesizing and analyzing the fire hose of information. And we'll do that in a couple of ways. The first is to blog, try and provide our own perspective on what the trends are. Our focus at the Social Capital Project is to really look at the sum of the parts. So what do the polls say over a year or over 3 years? And how do we look across the landscape and really see some key takeaways? We'll also be welcoming guest bloggers in. So if anyone from your network is working on related activities, we'd love to hear about that and feature it on the blog. And then, Meredith, I'm wondering if you want to jump in now and talk a little bit about the resource hub, which you'll find on slide 7.
Sure. So the resource hub is really the library for users of the site. We have a lot of different materials that are both accessible to the public, but then others that are accessible only to members of Climate Access. And the goal of the resource hub was really to collect key resources that are very focused on climate communications and behavior change. So this isn't a resource library kind of focused on climate change in general. We really have narrowed it down into those kind of resources that really focus on that communication and behavior change angle. So we've broken up the resource hub. You'll see there's a number of different categories and subcategories. We do a featured resource that we change about every week or every 2 weeks, something new and fresh that we think is interesting that we want to point out to different practitioners. And on that, we do a little summary, too, with the key points. And another interesting area of the resource hub is our collections, too. I think in the next slide, slide 8, we've broken out, showed kind of the page of the collection there. And that's another way for us to categorize the resources in the resource hub, and have broken down by different issue areas. This one's on climate justice. We have ones on extreme weather and engagement, a way for us to kind of create little packages of resources for you to see.
Well, let me just interject there for a second, Meredith, because one option, and we haven't gotten to this yet, we're just not quite at the 3-week point since launch, but would be to consider what a climate literacy collection would look like in terms of key resources. Because the idea here is really if you only have time to read some of the leading pieces of research and leading ideas, here's the sort of most critical set.
Yeah, that'd be great. And the resources, they really span from media articles to academic research, journal articles, so it's a broad range in that way of different things that we're adding in. And we also encourage people to upload their own resources, too. If you're a member of Climate Access, you're able to share your own resources with the network, and then we can also put those into the public side of the site also. Do you want me to talk about tips and tools, Kara?
Sure, that'd be great.
So another way that we kind of synthesize and analyze all the different information that's coming out is through our tips and tools area. This is slide 9. And we have a couple different sections within tips and tools. So we have tip sheets, interviews, roundtables, and then in the future we'll have case studies too. So the tip sheets, this is, I guess, even you can go over to the next slide, slide 10, to see a tip sheet page. These are kind of one-pagers that we create, really kind of short bullet point summaries of either research that we've done with the Social Capital Project or research from other sources also. So we take like a big 60-100 page report and kind of boil it down to that one pager that's really useful on, again, kind of communication strategies or public engagement, outreach, tactics, things like that. So really having that kind of quick summary that either after you read the report or before, kind of an easy, quick little summary to get at those main lessons. And we're also in the tips and tools area including transcripts of different interviews that we do. A lot of times in our blog we'll feature quotes from interviews that we've done with leading practitioners and academics in the field. So we include those the full interviews in our interview section here, and that's usually a member-only feature there. And our roundtables, these are going to be our webinars that we're hosting. Our first one is going to be next month, and we're going to be including the transcripts and also the audio recordings of those roundtables in this area also. And then in the future, have some case studies where we really get in-depth with communication and outreach strategies, and that will be in this area too.
Great, thanks.
And again, just like the resource hub, if you have a report or resource that you think would be a really good tip sheet where you'd like to see that kind of one-pager built out, we'd love to get those materials from you too.
Great, perfect. Well, and I think a couple of key things that Meredith mentioned was really in addition to the fact you can find all of the resources in one place that's related to this topic, we are providing sort of cheat sheets for each one to give you the overview to save time to really see what would be most helpful for your work. And a lot of the activity on climate access in terms of the network is in a password-protected member-only area, which allows us to really pick up on discussions around key pieces of research or other aspects of the site, which I'll move into now. If you move ahead to slide 11 and then quickly to slide 12. The next key point that I mentioned earlier was really illustrating how research ideas and what we think will work to engage the public in climate issues, how that's actually playing out in campaign work. If you move to slide 12, the core part of the network site that features this this area is the campaign gallery, where we're trying to build out a pretty extensive gallery of what is going on all across. Our focus right now is on the United States and Canada, but eventually there's no limit to what we could be adding here in terms of what's happening on the ground. And this will be another key thing that will be pushing different campaigns out into the member forums for discussion in terms of what people think is working or not working. We'll be interviewing some of the folks behind the campaigns. If you move to slide 13, one of the campaigns that we're currently featuring is one of your members, the Alliance for Climate Education's Do One Thing campaign, which we're real big fans of. So excited to see that campaign gallery grow over time, in addition to us sort of scanning the landscape and working with our partners to see what's available. We'll also be relying on our network members to provide great campaign ideas to us for discussion. Now, finally, just want to move into the third point, which I think really there could potentially be a great opportunity to collaborate with your network, and it's around the idea that we're gathering organizations and networks together into a conversation around public engagement and climate. If you move to slide 15, This is a screenshot of the member-only forum. So we're currently set up to allow any eligible staff from government or nonprofits or service providers in the communication space working with those sectors free membership into Climate Access. And once you everyone is screened into the network so that we are sure that every single member is a qualified practitioner. We also do have academics and experts in here as well. But there's a number of key features once you get into the password-protected area. This is where we can really kick off discussions about different campaigns that are happening, different research ideas we want to make sure get out there. It's where others can chime in and share information. This is a place where we can also allow materials for members only. So right now you'll see up there under recent resources a few sets of materials just produced by a new group, Climate Nexus, on how to talk about extreme weather and its relationship to climate. So we're able to make certain resources available to members that the authors don't want sort of more broadly published. And then the network directory really allows people to connect with one another. So once people are screened into the network, they become part of the network directory, and people can connect each other. And in less than 3 weeks, we already have more than 400 qualified members, and it's a pretty amazing group of people, again, pretty heavily concentrated right now on the U.S., but increasingly we're getting members from around the world. If you move to slide 16, one of the things that we're able to do with our platform is allow networks or organizations to have their own private forum within our site and to be able to manage that in how they want in terms of who has access into that group, being able to share materials confidentially, being able to organize different conversations within a network or an organization, and really sort of own your own part of Climate Access. At the same time, because you have to become a member of the basic Climate Access list, you're still part of that larger conversation. So you can be sharing information within your own team, but still know what is happening across the rest of the network. So we're pretty excited about this component of what we're doing. One of our pilot project partners is the Connect US Fund, and we're just getting going with them, but they have a U.S. climate leadership group that is basically practitioners from a whole range of environmental and peace and security organizations, and they are going to use Climate Access to help coordinate their communications function across that network. So we're really excited, and that might be something else to think about. I know that you're, you know, working on your own website and looking at tools to coordinate your work. One possibility is that we could provide some of that functionality that you might need within Climate Access. Moving to slide 17, just a quick look at the network directory. In addition to being able to contact people, the profiles can get pretty robust in terms of people sharing their area of expertise and interest. So people can find each other related to region or interest group that way. Eventually, we'll be able to have a number of different conversations going on either in private forums or just different discussion groups within the member forums. And over time, we anticipate this will become a really robust part of the network function. So just to wrap up and move into questions, you know, I think if at the end of the day, if we're successful with Climate Access, we will have really been able to provide practitioners with tools, moving on to slide 18, to really be more effective in engaging the public in climate issues. As I mentioned, we feel that's really essential to addressing the challenges that we're facing, that we will provide a landscape and assessment of what is going on in the field, what's working and what's not, and that the frames and approaches that are working get out there and replicated and amplified. So that's really what we're aiming to do, and we really look forward to a conversation with all of you as to how this tool might fit your needs. And just to quickly close, the last two slides, the last slide has my contact information, but just wanted to thank our founding partners. One is Rutgers Climate and Social Policy Initiative, and the Stonehouse Standing Circle, which is a new think tank founded by Dr. David Suzuki. So thank you all for the time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. That's very interesting. I'm not really sure, maybe you said, how long have you been in existence?
Well, the Social Capital Project has been around since 2005. I started it out of Earth Justice, and we moved to the Resource Innovation Group a couple of years ago, but Climate Access is only 3 weeks old. I guess then, 3 weeks tomorrow.
That's what I thought I understood. That's
pretty
amazing. You've moved things along really quickly.
Well, there was a lot behind the scenes before we went live. So it feels quick now, but it didn't feel that way last winter.
You went through those organizations a little bit quickly. I'm looking at your website. This is Dan Barstow, and I'm looking at your website, and you know, you mentioned Rutgers Climate Social Policy Institute, you mentioned Stonehouse Standing Circle, Social Capital Project, Resource Innovation Group, and right now in my mind they're all a blend, and maybe you could help just a little bit more about the background of those organizations.
Sure. Well, the Resource Innovation Group is the nonprofit 501c3 that we're part of, which is based in Oregon, and it's directed by Bob Doppelt, who's done a lot of work around sustainability and individual and organizational behavior change related to that. And the Social Capital Project is one of the main programs of the Resource Innovation Group. As I mentioned, we started initially at Earth Justice when I was the Vice President of Communications there, and really started the Social Capital Project because of what I felt was a complete failure to communicate environmental issues with the public in a way that actually led to effective enforcement of environmental legislation. But we moved to the Resource Innovation Group because of the broader platform TRIG has in working not only in the nonprofit community, but also with government and business. Rutgers has been a partner with us. They have a program at Rutgers called the Climate and Social Policy Initiative, which is relatively new. It was founded by Dr. Martin Bunzel. And it's basically an effort to try and coordinate all of the climate change research going on across the Rutgers community. And they partnered with us because part of the mandate that they have is to really try and make sure that research that is being generated in the climate area is getting into use in the field. And then finally, the Stonehouse Standing Circle. We're very grateful for their support. It is an effort out of Vancouver, British Columbia. It was founded by Dr. David Suzuki and another gentleman whose name is Jim Hogan, who's author of the book Climate Cover-Up and has the Smog Blog and Energy Boom blogs as well. So he's very focused in some of the skeptics' debates. So those were our founding partners.
Also, if you go to the Climate Access website under About Us and then Partners, there's a little more information about each and links to the various websites.
And then for Climate Access, we do have an advisory board specifically for this project, which you can also see on the website, and it is a mix of researchers and practitioners.
Thank you. And you're physically based in Oregon?
TRIG is.
Okay.
Are there other questions?
So this is Mark McCaffrey, and Carrie, you came to some of the meetings that Steve Adams organized about climate adaptation, right?
Yeah, I did. It's nice to hear your voice.
I knew we had crossed paths, and I'm excited to see this starting to come to fruition.
Well, and the Adaptation Network is still coming together, too. Steve is still moving that forward, which is exciting, and we do anticipate an overlap, and, you know, we'll probably be supporting some of the network activities in the communication sense on the website. The whole topic of adaptation communications is something that, well, I've been focused on since I guess I met you, and I would like to see that built out as a key discussion on climate access. I think it's really critical that we move into that conversation.
And do you have any ties with the Climate Adaptation Knowledge Exchange?
We're definitely colleagues with them, and we asked them for advice when we were in our development phase. We had them look at our platform and give us feedback, and they've been promoting us and vice versa. And I think really we'll move into, now that we're up and running, a more formal partnership around some content exchanges.
Right.
Yeah.
So one thing that could be a potential collaboration sooner than later with the Climate Literacy Network is the project that is funded by NSF, the Climate Literacy Energy Awareness Network, or CLEAN. And I don't know if you've taken a look at that lately, but we're about to release an expanded catalog of online resources that we've vetted for quality that relate to climate and energy. And we have already about 100 resources in the catalog, and there'll be
it's well over 250.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm really, well, they're not all
live
yet.
Yes, they are. Over 250 are live.
Yeah, so
290.
We're going to have a widget that potentially could be embedded in your website that would allow people to search the CLEAN catalog and get access to high-quality resources that we've already reviewed and annotated.
Will you be at the AGU meeting?
Yes.
I know you, Mark. I was talking to Kara.
All right.
No, but I am going to be at the Behavior, Energy, and Climate Conference. I don't know if any of you attend that meeting.
No, the reason I'm asking is that we are aiming to the widget that Mark is talking about. We're going to really be promoting that, and it will be ready for us to sort of be sharing with people. In fact, we might even give a talk on this Climate Literacy Network call introducing it, so maybe you'll want to be part of that conversation. But at the AGU meeting, we'll be the first time we're going to be promoting it widely. But it's as Mark said, it's a tool that will allow, since the CLEAN collection, we put all the resources through a very rigorous review process, and 5 to 7 pairs of eyes that with educational and scientific expertise look at these resources before they're brought into the collection. But then it allows you to put this widget, the set of coding that you can do a search from your own site, and you never leave your own site, but it draws the resources from the reviewed collection around those particular topics. So that might be of interest to you and to maybe others that are on the call.
Well, that would be a fantastic, because we have not focused yet on, you know, the more formal education side, and that, you know, isn't really our area of expertise. So being able to partner with you in that regard, and I believe that with the members we already have, just within the first 3 weeks, there are quite a few practitioners who are focused in formal education.
Mm-hmm.
So that
a
would
lot
be
of these
great.
Resources yeah. are that can be used in formal education don't necessarily, I mean, they can be also amenable to informal, because a lot of them, well, the first year we focused on learning activities, which obviously lend themselves to formal education. This year we've opened it up, and we have videos and visualizations and experiments, things that can be either in a formal education context or an informal education context. It can be used and fit into any kind of program that people might be developing.
Oh, that's great.
So this is the thing people don't know. A couple things, and I really value your work. While we do communications, education, engagement at the federal level, obviously working through networks of networks is critical. And so there are a couple of key questions I had. The But the other thing is the amount of activity going on in this area, and when I say this area, I mean, you know, engagement with citizens at all levels, whether it's formal, informal, non-formal, public, adult, you know, it's not. And the two projects that jumped out at me that NSF is funding through the Climate Change Education Partnership Grant, being very close to what you're doing, you've connected with them, is the George Mason University funded grant about working on with broadcast meteorologists as a key engagement personnel. That they just had a meeting yesterday about all this and all the research and their finding, and so imagine that. And then the other project is the one that University of San Diego is doing, which is on a key, I guess, strategy on using influentials. And this is not a new thing. Lots of people have been working on influentials, but it would seem to me that you know, pulling those into this network of networks. Is that part of your strategy, is like trying to get a critical mass?
Yeah, and, you know, I think there's both, you know, we want everyone, as I said, to be qualified in, so there's both sort of a, you know, size of network goal, but more importantly, do we have the right influencers within the network as well? Both Ed and Tony from Climate Communication Center are advisors for us, so... you know, we'll be able to circle back with them and talk about ways to collaborate. I hadn't heard about the University of San Diego work, so that's extremely helpful.
Sure.
One of the things that Tony is working on, though, that I could really see us using in terms of having a really sharp strategic focus on how we build out the network. So, you know, at this phase, there are some partners who are obvious. But as we grow, we're really going to have to be deliberate about who we're trying to bring into the network. And then when we are sort of going above and beyond just our basic level of service, where we're really focusing on nurturing the conversations. And one of the things that Tony Lizerowitz has been working on is a scan of all of the organizations across the United States that are actively communicating on climate. And I believe he looked across sectors. So that is a tool he's putting together that I think it'll end up being a web-based tool, but we'll be able to use it to help decide. You know, it's basically a map of who's out there in positions to influence the public on these issues. So I think when we have that at our disposal, it'll really give us an opportunity to have some pretty particular aspects of the universe and the map out there that we're really focused on engaging in this.
Mm-hmm.
But we've started with, you know, over the last, I would say, 2.5 years, because we've trained several thousand practitioners, we're starting with, you know, where we already have the relationships and where we've been working and then building out from there.
Another bit of research that Tony's working on with others is on the connection between adolescents and parents or their adults, and that really draws a strong connection between the work that you're describing and the work that we principally do, not exclusively, but because the you know adolescents are a key audience for influencing their adults. And some of the early research is showing that there is a very positive connection between the work that a child will do with their adult versus working with that adult directly. It's not only, but it's a powerful vector, if you follow me.
That's great, yeah. Yeah, I knew that he had started on that. I wasn't sure how far along, though, the work was. So that's good.
It's not out there yet, but they're publishing some papers on this exact work very soon.
Okay, so, great. Yeah, and I mean, those are the exact types of things that if you are coming across, we would really greatly appreciate hearing about, because then we can really help get it out there and, you know, even be interviewing different researchers and practitioners around some of the key findings and topics. So that's
yep.
Extremely helpful.
And I also wanted to say that I was very happy to hear the adaptation conversation came up. That's a very important piece of the equation. So I urge you guys to keep that. That's wonderful.
Well, and it is exciting what Steve Adams is up to, trying to build out this, I mean, not unlike what you guys are doing, you know, a network of key practitioners in adaptation. The communications piece was identified really early on and is a key component of the business plan for building out that strategy. And while all of that's been happening in the U.S., in Canada there's a really interesting network now of adaptation professionals that has been coordinated by this body of provincial governments as well as a number of universities. And they're really quite far along in terms of developing the field of adaptation work, but also looking at some of the communication issues, and in some pretty interesting contexts, like with Inuit youth, and in places outside of just the big centers. So yeah, I'm excited. It kind of feels like it was something that we were trying to get going and trying to get going, and for better or for worse, we're sort of in the impacts conversation now, but it does feel like people are really starting to focus on it more. We've been involved with WWF and Mark Melman, who are working right now on quite a good body of research in the U.S. I think it'll end up being about 6 or 8 focus groups and a national survey, which will really be the most extensive body of research done yet on adaptation communication. So that's something that'll be, you know, out in a few weeks, and hopefully we'll be able to help get out to the field.
Right.
So this is Tamara Levy. Another thing that we might find areas of common interest and possible partnership is that in the clean pathway collection or effort, one of the avenues is not only to address the climate science, but solutions. And a lot of what you're doing has to do with behavior change, which addresses solutions. And so that might be an area where we might be able to leverage each other's efforts.
Yeah, that would be really, really helpful. I mean, part of what we've sketched out for this year and we'll be doing moving forward is really sort of a teaching and a skills agenda. And we'll be doing that in part based on where the public is at on these issues and what we really need to do to respond to that. To me, one of the biggest challenges is, and I've just looked at 2 new studies that show fatalism is on the rise. And it actually is really problematic with people who end up really starting to get engaged in environmental and climate issues, that they can end up being the ones who feel extremely fatalistic about our ability to address the challenge. And so I think the focus on solutions is just so critical from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what we're mostly looking for in ours is the mandate for our funded project. Certainly the Climate Literacy Network itself is beyond this, but for the funded project, we're really looking for resources that are used in educational contexts that can address solutions. So if you come across things that are like that, we could potentially put them through the review processes we have in CLEAN to make them available in those educational contexts.
Okay, that's an interesting idea.
And then we might have things in the collection now, I know I have to actually search, but that actually address some of these solutions. But they're probably integrated with information about the science. Are there other questions? Well, we really appreciate your making this presentation today. I've visited your Facebook site as well as your website. And I think that the number of people that like your website has gone up during this past hour.
Yay. Great. Well, we really appreciate the opportunity to be in touch with all of you, and we'll look forward to following up when your widget is ready. That sounds like a great start. And then we will be thinking, though, about as we're adding to our resource library materials that might be good to send your way for vetting. So that sounds like a great start for some possible collaboration.
Okay. Very good.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next week we are going to have another presentation on navigating climate change in the classroom, Teacher Preparation Practices and Perceptions that will be given by Susan Burr at Ceres at the University of Colorado Boulder. So, and that will be our just before Thanksgiving talk. All right, thanks everybody for calling in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,